Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. On our way to our conversation about what's happening in Officer Nero's trial, I want to remind you that Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. We're now going to take a look at what's happening in the trial of Officer Nero that is coming up. Interesting kind of battle, legal battles going on between the prosecution and defense, what this says about the future of this trial. We are joined by A. Dwight Pettit. One of our leading defense attorneys in Baltimore has represented clients in lawsuits against police in misconduct cases and much more. And, of course, is representing Tyrone West's family. Dwight, good to have you on the air with us.
Glad to be here, Mark.
And Doug Colbert will be joining us shortly, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, and you at 410-319-8888. You can email us to talk@steinershow.org. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner, but do join us, 410-319-8888. So, Dwight, this is really, we just heard, I think this came over the transom, that Officer Nero's defense has chosen to be tried by judge and not jury. What does that mean? And what do you think that means for the case?
Well, I think it's a very intelligent decision by Officer Nero's team, because here we're dealing with a lot of legal questions, more so than factual questions. With the jury, you're dealing with the fact of the state probably would have preferred that because you have more of an emotional factor. By going with the judge is going to be compelled to follow the law. And so in this particular instance, I think the argument for the defense is that the law is on their side.
An interesting point of view. Doug, how do you see this decision by...
Well, first thing we have to keep in mind is that it was not the prosecution's preference to try Officer Nero next. They would have liked to have retried Officer Porter, and then they had Officer Goodson, who was the driver, who was supposed to be next, and Sergeant White. So this is not the order of preference. Having said that, it is the defendant's right to choose a judge as opposed to a jury. It's not a usual choice that people make. People usually have much more confidence in trying a case before 12 people because if they can convince one person not to vote guilty, then it's a hung jury. So in this situation, it's likely, as Dwight points out, that the defense feels more confident and comfortable with a judge making these rulings. Unfortunately, it denies the community participation in the outcome of the case.
But it's we have that legal right to choose judge or jury.
In Maryland, you do. But in Virginia, for instance, it's got to get judge approval whenever a person waives a jury trial because of the public interest in jury participation. And in federal system, you also have to get judicial approval. So we allow the accused to make that decision.
That's interesting. So does that mean, Dwight, that from what you both just said, before I ask some very specific questions about what they want to admit and not admit and where this case might go, that this particular case and these cases in general in these series around the death of Freddie Gray are difficult to prosecute and difficult to convict?
Well, in this instance, it is a very difficult question or difficult prosecution, and it's really a novel question as to whether or not you can bring criminal sanctions or get criminal sanctions for officers who make decisions in terms of probable cause and reasonable suspicion. And the state is arguing that when they make those decisions and they are wrong, then they have criminal liability and responsibility. The defense is arguing that they do not as a matter of law because the court excuses them or the law excuses them because as long as they're acting in good faith, they are not expected to be lawyers in interpretation of the law as to when they have probable cause or a reasonable suspicion. And therefore, they are sort of immune from criminal sanctions, even if they make the wrong decision, as long as they're acting in good faith. And this, and you know, Doug can correct me, but this is probably the one of the first instances for this question to be determined by a court, maybe not only in the state, but maybe nationally.
I mean, that is what I've been reading, too. This is a really unique case.
Well, what's unique about it is that you have a local prosecutor who's saying that an arrest must take place when there's probable cause to charge someone with a crime. That's not novel. That's in our Constitution.
But let me ask you this question, Doug, and then jump back into it. And folks, do join us at 410-319-8888. I mean, as some pointed out, and I've been reading other places, I mean, prosecutors often find officers lack probable cause for an arrest, right? And so they and they dismiss the case or whatever. And they might yell at the officers and say this is – well, they might not. But I can't remember another time when officers were arrested for arresting somebody they thought they didn't have probable cause for arresting.
Well, they're saying that if the police had no basis to charge someone with a crime – let's say the police officer is making the whole thing up to cover himself – and the prosecutor is saying that in those situations, the police should not have made an arrest. And therefore, whatever the police officer does after arrest in terms of assaultive conduct will not be protected or justified. So what's unusual here, Mark, is that the prosecutor, our prosecutor, the state's attorney, Ms. Mosby, is saying that we will protect officers who use force when the arrest is a good arrest. But when there are bad arrests, and in this city there are many, many bad arrests that take place, that the police officer should have probable cause. In other words, think before you make the arrest.
So from what Doug is saying, Dwight, and I want to get into more specifics about the case, but I really want to pursue this for a moment. So what Dwight is saying, it seems to me, is that if this case goes through, the prosecutor prosecutes this case by saying that there was no probable cause, this was a bad arrest, and Freddie Gray died as a result of this bad arrest, that can call into question in terms of larger policy about the tens of thousands of people who get arrested under similar circumstances in the city every day. Well, not 10,000 every day, but people get arrested like this every day. Dwight?
Yeah, oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, this, as I said, I think it's a policy question that not only is the state watching, but the nation is watching, because I don't recall. The sanction is usually dismissal of the case. Now, I think it's a very bold step that she's taken, and I applaud it, but I can understand the apprehension of the police department if there is a conviction for what they consider to be a decision that's made on the spur of the moment, that officers should not be held responsible when they make the wrong decision, as long as it's in good faith. Now, that's the count of the state has counted that, well, we need to look at each situation individually and not just the broad general aspect of it. And I think then that's what Doug was saying when it comes into play. If you look and you say, well, hey, the arrest was obviously wrong and everything was prefabricated post-arrest to justify the arrest, then you've got a lot of ammunition to support a conviction. But the other argument that the defense is going to make, and I'm wearing both hats here because, I prosecute police all the time, but also defend a lot of people in terms of criminal cases. And what the police are arguing is that, there's a certain leeway that they should be entitled to and as a matter of law. And then we're going to get into certain issues. What the court is going to get into is those issues which we've been debating the whole time of the Freddie Gray situation, and that's the chase, which the Supreme Court has sort of indicated it was valid because of eye contact and running in a crime area, high crime area. And then we get to the question that the state had sort of abandoned, I thought, when they dropped the false imprisonment, and that was the legality of the knife. So we're going to have a lot of legal questions that are going to be answered by Judge Williams for the first time that have been raised throughout this particular case in terms of, first of all, the chase, secondly, the apprehension, and third, the arrest and the justification for that based on the legality or illegality of the knife. So a lot of questions that have been floating will be answered or should be answered in the motions as well as the fact the trial of the Nero case.
Keep in mind, though, Mark, that there are three charges against Officer Nero. So one of them is the assault that we've been talking about. The other one is what's taking place inside the police van when Officer Nero apparently assisted Officer Miller in placing Freddie Gray inside the van.
Without restraints.
Without restraints. So that becomes the reckless endangerment charge. And that's the charge that says that he left Freddie Gray in a situation where he faced the likelihood of substantial physical injury or death. That's different from what we're talking about in terms of an assault that may have taken place after Freddie Gray was placed under arrest. And then the third charge, of course, is official misconduct. So we've got three different charges here, but we only have one trier of the fact, and that's Judge Williams. So one thing we could be sure of, there will not be a mistrial.
And Doug is absolutely correct in that.
Right.
Very much correct. Because remember, the jury, if I think I'm correct in saying, when they counted the votes in terms of the initial Porter trial, there was a tendency, or a numerical count, to convict on the misconduct, where they were going to acquit on the other charges. And so here, as Doug just pointed out, you know, we were talking about the assault charge, but you've got the reckless endangerment, which involves the van, and then you got the overall charge of misconduct. So he does have some leeway, but as you all just indicated, there will not be a mistrial.
So let me open the phones here. I have questions about the knife. I have questions here about why the city prosecutors are not saying that that Freddie Gray was injured during the arrest, because that is the popular wisdom out here. I'm going to talk a bit about that, what that means, and the question of whether or not the defense attorneys do not want the video to be, any videos to be shown with or without sound. 410-319-8888. Chris, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
I'm calling this. I heard Professor Colbert's comments regarding the charges for essentially related to an illegal stop. And my question is about the consistency in that notion, which I agree with, but then I don't understand why the state's attorney won't reopen the case of Tyrone West, which was essentially the same case. I mean, what was the probable cause for the initial stop that led to his death? And I understand that was a prior administration, but this current state's attorney has weighed in on it, saying that she won't reopen the case, which was a case that had been essentially carried over from the prior administration. So I'm just trying to see where the consistency is in the logic.
That's really interesting. Let me ask Dwight first. I mean, Dwight, can you speak to that? I know you're defending the West family, so I'm not sure you can speak to that, but can you?
Well, I think that the what the state is really relying on in terms of the decision in the first case, the first administration, when they refused to prosecute, is the fact, you got to remember, and it's almost the same thing that's come up in the Freddie Gray case, and that's the analysis and the conclusions of the pathologist. I think that's what they believe was the weakest part in terms of following with the prosecution, that in West, the pathologist concluded, which we now believe we have contradicted with other medical testimony, but the original conclusion that it was a pre-existing condition and heat and so forth that caused a heart failure. And I always objected to that. And so what Ms. Mosby said, I think, trying to paraphrase, was that if you come up with additional evidence, then we might reconsider. But that evidence is not going to the issue of the probable cause of the stop or the reasonableness of the stop. But I think the basis of what they were looking at was the conclusion of the pathologist, which also has confused the Freddie Gray case, because a lot of the argument that's being made is that Freddie Gray's death, his injuries occurred while he was being arrested, where the pathologist concluded that it was in the van. So in both cases, you had really, really big deficits in terms of of the conclusions of the Maryland State Medical Office. And so that's the distinction that I see, that now there is some evidence that is in opposition to that, which Ms. Mosby has, that she didn't have before. That would be my analysis between those two cases.
Anything to add to that, Dr. Dahl?
Well, I certainly agree with Dwight that I read the statement to say that we are not closing the door on reviewing Tyrone West's killing or death, but what we are saying is that there has to be something else. I believe that once these police trials are getting Miss Mosby's full attention right now, and what she's saying in terms of this office and Nero and to the other officers on the Baltimore City Police Force is, you must have probable cause to make an arrest. And if you don't have the probable cause, we are going to look very closely to see whether or not you engage in criminal activity after making an unlawful arrest.
So what about, I was thinking about the confusion in the public's mind, especially around the pathology reports in both cases and what really caused the death, and how the defense does not want these videos shown of that people in the community took of Freddie Gray's arrest, where he obviously seems in pain and impaired, at least our casual view of it, that he seemed not to be able to stand correctly, his leg, dragging a leg, screaming in pain, and to say that not to kind of wrestle with the issue when he was, I mean, how this affects the case, A, from the defense side, if they throw those videos out, but B, the whole question of when he was hurt, I mean, which I guess they can't bring up because of the pathology report. This is always, I think for the public, this is a very confusing point.
And I think what you have to look at is each individual charge. So when you have the reckless endangerment, that's where the prosecution can bring in an expert to show that the way in which the officers left Freddie Gray in without protection, handcuffed and apparently injured, would have placed him in a situation of opening him up to potential serious physical injury or death. So, see, because Officer Nero's not charged with anything to do with the killing of Freddie Gray, but one of the elements of the reckless count is that you left somebody in such a precarious perilous situation, that's how you can bring in some of the information about what Officer Nero faced when he placed Freddie Gray inside the van. You're not going to get as far in this trial as you did in the Porter trial and as you might in the Goodson or Sergeant White trial, because Officer Nero's role happens in the beginning. So we get to understand, why did the police chase Freddie Gray? Is it simply that you live, you know, in one neighborhood and someone else lives in another, and in your neighborhood, because there's high crime, if you take a look at the police and you run, that gives the police reasonable suspicion to believe that you're involved in criminal activity. So there's a lot that's going to come out here about the differences that take place in policing in different parts of Baltimore.
So this will go to trial fairly quickly.
Oh, right? Yeah. I think one thing with Judge Williams, I mean, he's a no-nonsense judge to begin with. But when you don't have a jury, you have far fewer delays. You don't have all these bench conferences that you have to say things out of the presence of the jury. I mean, judges actually believe that they put aside all emotion and they can only judge the case on the evidence. Judge Williams, I'm sure he believes that he'll be able to put aside anything that's extraneous. So he will allow more evidence to come in a bench trial than he would in a jury trial.
So the argument, Dwight, that the defense is using right now to say that we should not raise any of the issues of how Freddie Gray died or Freddie Gray's death in this, because it's not relevant to their case. How do you think that's going to play with Judge Williams?
Well, those are motions that are being made now by the defense, which are academically proper, because they're going to try to silence anything that they can silence, and the argument, as Doug stated, is, hey, the medical report says the death occurred in the van, he's charged with assault, he's not charged with manslaughter, and therefore that is not relevant. But I tend to think, and I could be wrong, I tend to think that Judge Williams standing true to form in his past rulings is going to deny most of the motions and allow, as Doug just indicated, the evidence to come in trial. And so I think they're going to get past the motions. I think most of the motions will be denied, and the argument for the court will order that let's go to trial, and then the court will make those decisions in terms of law and fact as the evidence comes in. And that would be the best way to, in fact, ensure a fair trial and also to reduce the possibility of reversible error.
And once again, Dwight Pettit has shown why he is one of Baltimore's best attorneys, because without even being in the courtroom, he's absolutely correct. The judge denied virtually all the motions to preclude evidence. And really what the judge is going to do is he's going to make these rulings during the case itself, and he'll make a decision whether it appears more relevant to allow something in, less prejudicial. He pretty much feels that there's not too much that's going to prejudice his view of the evidence because he's not going to be moved by emotion. Now, whether or not that's true or not is a separate question, but I do believe that this judge, like most judges, will do his best to decide the case solely on evidence.
So so the question about this knife and placing him in the van, where do you all see that going in this? I mean, this seems to be a major factor. I'm reading something here that he couldn't breathe, requested an inhaler, but to no avail. Officer Miller and Nero then placed Mr. Gray in a seated position, substantially found a knife clipped to the inside of his pants pocket. The blade of the knife was folded in the handle. The knife was not a switchblade and is lawful under Maryland law, which I think is being contested. These officers then removed the knife and placed it on the sidewalk. So these were comments by Marilyn Mosby that Justin Fenton just put out. So what about this tarpon case? This seems to be a critical piece here.
Well, the knife itself is going to come into play in terms of whether the police had lawful reason to place Freddie Gray under arrest, and that would have taken place outside the van. That would have happened when the bikers finally apprehended.
Police bikes, but
the police bikers,
right.
Apprehended and arrested him. So we don't know for sure what the testimony is going to be, but my guess would be that the police witnesses will testify that they observed the knife before placing Freddie Gray under arrest, and that therefore gave them reason to believe that Freddie Gray had committed a crime.
But
and then we're back to where we started, whether the knife is legal or illegal. The state has seemed to me tried to move away from that argument by saying that the whole apprehension, the whole scenario of facts, for bringing him down and after the probable cause or reasonable suspicion for the chase, but when they brought him down, that was the illegal arrest and the knife is therefore not relevant. The defense is going to argue that the decision to arrest was made predicated upon the knife, and the knife is illegal under Baltimore City ordinance, where it might have been legal under Maryland state law.
You know, Mark, one of the things that's going on here, and I think the listeners are aware of this, but in our city and state, it's the police who decide whether or not to bring criminal charges against someone. In almost every other place in the country that I'm aware of, it's always the prosecutor who makes that decision after discussing with the police the arrest itself and whether it was a lawful arrest and whether there's enough evidence there. In some ways, there is a power struggle going on here between the police, who want to retain the right not only to arrest but to charge people with crimes, and the prosecutor, who's saying, we've had so many unlawful arrests in Baltimore. Our conviction rate here is about 35%, which is extremely low. But by nature of the arrests that the police make, many people spend that time in jail because they can't afford bail, etc.
Right.
So the struggle that's going on here now is that the police are saying that we make the decision that this knife is unlawful. The prosecutor can come in later and second-guess us, but she can't say that we had no lawful reason to make the arrest in the first place.
I just a matter to clear up very quickly. Isn't there law that says what knife is legal or illegal to carry? Isn't there a law that clearly states what kind of knife is legal and what's not legal?
The issue is around whether it's a spring loaded knife, and there seems to be a difference of interpretation of law between the city ordinance and the state law as to whether or not where this knife falls in terms of its legality. And that will be something that, Doug, that I think they're probably going to put on experts to try to make that factual determination.
So I'm curious how you think this is going to proceed. I mean, I'm not actually to predict, but I'm just – you both have been in court a great deal. I mean, and I've said earlier in the program that I've read other people saying that these are very difficult cases to prosecute and convict.
Well, that's been the regular opinion. I mean, there are so many so-called experts who have really called into question this prosecution, where other people, including myself, feel that it's really important for the public to hear the evidence, to see the witnesses, and then for there to be transparency. So I've always applauded the prosecution because I believe that they believe that there's sufficient evidence to charge the officers. What happens in this case? Probably the assault charge will be the more difficult of the three, the easier one for the officers. From what I know of the case, which of course is limited, I think the other two charges seem well within reach of the prosecution's ability to establish a case.
So, Dwight, we have like 30 seconds. What a final thought?
I agree wholeheartedly. I think they're going to really have problems with the assault charge, but I think they could make the case on reckless endangerment, and the catch-all, of course, would be the misconduct.
I will say one thing, Mark, that the police have really done well when they choose judge trials.
Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, and Dwight Pettit, leading defense attorney, represents many clients in lawsuits against police and misconduct cases. Thank you both so much. Look forward to your further commentary during the trials.
You're very welcome, Mark. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Dwight. And thank you all for being part of the show today and listening in and calling in and writing in. The Mark Sanna Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Theme music is by Warren Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. The podcast of Mark Steiner Show. Share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.